I'm from a place where revolutions slowly suffocate. From sarin gas and selfishness, and freedom's a mirage. My people stared at bat with helplessness when SOS alerts were sent. Nobody got the messages.
Hello and welcome to the Harvard Islamica podcast. I'm Harry Bostromudge.
And I'm Mariam Kazmi. We're excited to have as our guest today Dr. Hossein Rashid, a scholar of Islam whose research focuses on Muslims and American popular culture. Hossein received his PhD in Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations, focusing on South and Central Asia at Harvard, and has since taught at many universities. Hossein writes and speaks about music, comics, movies, and the blogosphere. Our conversation today will be about Hossein's recent publication, Islam in North America, An Introduction, a volume he co-edited with Homa Mohibullah and Vincent Biondo. Welcome, Hossein.
Thank you, Mariam. Thank you, Harry, for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, of course. It's great to have you here. To get us started, can you tell us a little bit more about your professional background and what led you to publish this volume?
Yeah, I think for me, I'm not a traditional academic in the sense that I didn't go from graduate school straight into a tenure track job and sort of move on with an academic career. I came out of an intellectual positioning as an undergraduate. I was at Columbia College in New York City, where I had the privilege of taking a couple of courses with the late, great Edward Said. And one of his books that he never taught, but I read and really had a profound influence on me and helped me understand what I thought I wanted to do with my degree, with my academic degree, was a book he called Representations of the Intellectual, where he talks about the distinction. I'm really oversimplifying this for those of your listeners who may be familiar with it, but recognize we have a limited amount of time here. That where he talks about the idea of academia as a way to reproduce structures of power, and the intellectual is taking learning and education as a way to disrupt and challenge structures of power. I was working on my PhD. I'd actually just finished my generals or qualifying exams, depending what school you're in, but here at Harvard we call them the general exams, just before September 11th, 2001. And so I really found my voice as somebody engaged with broader publics in that space, an American-born Muslim, which is surprisingly not as unusual as most Islamophobes would have you think, but born and bred in New York, which was obviously an important part of the narrative, working on a Harvard PhD in Islamic studies. So it was really a confluence of events that led me to work with community organizations, churches, synagogues, interfaith communities, political organizations. I had the privilege of working on Howard Dean's presidential campaign briefly before moving over to, at the time, Senator John Kerry's presidential campaign briefly, and really sort of working in that space. So a lot of the work that I've done is really this type of public education, public engagement, in terms of thinking about religion broadly and Islam specifically. So long answer to a short question, but it then brought me a lot of my academic publishing has really been the idea that I'm not writing for tenure as tenure begins to die, because I'm not writing for the guild. I'm writing for public purposes. I'm writing to change public understandings of religion. And so the style I prefer to write in, I don't think it's intellectually weak, but I think it's much more accessible. And that's really what I'm aiming for. And those are the people I try to work with. And that led to this volume on Islam in North America, to really think about who are some interesting people doing work on Muslims in America that's not being covered elsewhere. And I'm really grateful for colleagues and mentors like Edward Curtis and Keisha Ali and Lori Silvers, who've really just done a lot to help create this space and create that ecosystem where we can having these conversations that are academically rigorous but are not guild-focused. And, you know, when we put this volume together, it was reaching out to colleagues and friends, because it'll make the writing process easier. But we also had these intellectual commitments, not just in terms of shared questions or shared grounding conversational pieces that we could see interlocking, but our authors, we didn't want to create a volume where people were being extractive in their relationship to community, that they had to have, the authors had to have some ongoing relationship with the communities about which they were writing. And it was really important for us that we didn't recreate those systems of academia where it's like, drop in, let me observe you, thank you, goodbye.
Mm.
But how does this help build up those communities, right? If we are talking about not doing traditional academia, but doing the work of an intellectual rather than simply writing for the guild, rather than simply getting promoted within the guild, but saying that education is meant to be a liberatory process, how do we take the communities we're engaging with on that journey with us? So it's not the solo act. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the ways we were trying philosophically to try to disrupt these capitalist and white supremacist systems that say there can only be one, mm-hmm. and really try to say, no, it's all of us or none of us.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So the topics in this book are far-ranging, from North American Muslim geography to Islamophobia as racism to Sufism in Mexico, some examples.
Yeah.
How did you decide what themes to include, being, as you said, expansive but not comprehensive?
So here I really want to thank our editor at Bloomsbury Law, Paul Scrape, who actually came to me and suggested this volume. They were working on this series. This is actually part of a series on Bloomsbury Academic on religions in North America. So they really saw North America as being the entire North American continent. So the Caribbean, Mexico, the United States, Canada. And so that really helped shape the types of people we would reach out to, people who were thinking transnationally, people who were thinking comparatively. So that helped shape the volume a little bit. So you mentioned our chapter on Sufism in Mexico, which was a surprise. It was a scholar I met through the call for this volume who's writing about somebody, briefly, who is very important to my own personal and professional development, Sheikh Noor Lex Hickson, who started the Sufi community, this particular Sufi community that Luciana is writing about in the volume. In Mexico. So that was really sort of the ideas. Who's writing about this space? Who's writing about it comparatively in really interesting ways? And what are some of the things that we think would be surprising for a public audience? Again, I'm going to focus a little bit on my own work, but you'll see my colleague Huma has also done some public work in this space. But I'd done a New York Times op-doc on the history of Muslims in America. I just came out or worked on a recently released PBS digital series on the history of Muslims in America. I've worked on museum exhibitions. So, you know, through all those sorts of public engagements and like where these become repositories of knowledge, what's the gaps in these repositories of knowledge? So those became the two constraints. What does the press need? What are they suggesting? Who's available to write into those spaces? And what am I thinking of as something I haven't done that I want to learn? For me, all these engagements are places to learn for me as well. And that really just helped shape an expansive vision of what this could be, knowing full well we couldn't be comprehensive. So we leaned hard into the fact that we could not tell a linear story, and we wanted there to be big, obvious gaps so people could say, and what about, and what about, and what about? Yeah, and what about? Let's fill in those gaps rather than saying we're trying to do everything all at once.
Great. Thank you. To familiarize our audience with a little bit more of the history of Muslims in America, can you tell us a little bit about the main patterns of arrival of Muslims in North America?
So, you know, one of the tricky things with this question is that if we try to do it as a straight history, right, we can talk about individual Muslims coming over. There's some people who speculate that Muslims came before Columbus as individual explorers. They could have been Chinese Muslim explorers. They could have been from West Africa. Again, this is more speculative. I haven't seen anything as definitive as I would like from an evidentiary perspective, but there's enough suggested material that I think we have to take it seriously. We do get more substantive evidence with Columbus's expeditions, as we know. Columbus's expeditions in part were funded by the Reconquista, so the expropriation of wealth of Muslim and Jewish communities in the Iberian Peninsula enabled the expeditions of Columbus for Isabel and Ferdinand to fund Columbus's expeditions. And so as Muslims and Jews were being slaughtered in the Iberian Peninsula or being driven out, the decisions, the choices they were given were leave, convert, or die, and we can get into sort of pseudo-conversions at another point. But people did, you know, we have evidence that people ended up on Columbus ships, but we also know with other Spanish explorers that there were lots of individual Muslims. But I think if we talk about larger social patterns of migration, we really talk about, we really sort of focus on the period of enslavement, because about 10 to 12% of enslaved Muslims in what would become the United States, enslaved peoples in what would become the United States were Muslim. And when we look at patterns of larger migration to the United States, we really start with the period of enslavement, where 10 to 12% of all enslaved peoples brought into what would become the United States, we believe to be Muslim. And that's transmitted over generations. We see this as late as, you know, for example, the Amistad case, where we know that people were Muslim on the Amistad. Then the next point, a large point of migration of Muslims, is the Arab migration of the mid to late 19th century. These are people coming from the Ottoman Empire. So the Ottoman Empire is vast. We tend to categorize them as Syrian or Lebanese, Turkish, even sometimes Greek. Most of these migrants tend to be Christian. But again, here we're looking at somewhere between 10 and 15% on the low end as being Muslim. So we've got these large populations coming in, and they're coming in to work, you know, at places like Dearborn for the Ford Motor Company in Michigan as places of high income. They became peddlers. They traveled the country. So we find one of the oldest mosques, some of the oldest mosques in the United States are actually in the Midwest, Ross, North Dakota, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And then we get the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act, which opens up a lot of Asian migrants to come into the United States, many of whom are Muslim, and we see that continuing on in 1986 and so on, but we're sort of in that wave. Despite all this idea of Muslims being migrants, of course, the largest number ethnically, racially, of Muslims in the United States are African-American, at roughly a third of the entire U.S. Muslim population. And I think this often gets lost when we talk about these migration patterns, is just how long a history Muslims have had in the United States and how much of it is tied to the Black experience in this country.
So almost there is an organic Muslim community in North America in some respects. I mean, thinking about them, you know, being part of the fabric and the creation of the United States back to enslavement in
absolutely
Colombian times.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, at one point, Michelle Obama, when she was first lady, had made a comment. I'm going to paraphrase here. But that how the White House was built by Black people. And the fact of the matter is, yes, it was. And probably a fair number of those were Muslim. You know, for example, we know, or we suspect, I shouldn't say we know, but based on naming patterns, based on statistics, that people like Jefferson and Washington enslaved Muslims as part of that. We have towns all throughout the country. We have towns named Muhammad and Mecca and Medina and Al-Qadir and Allah, Arizona, which is one of my favorites. right? So Alhambra. So we have this as part of the history of the United States.
Very interesting.
Yeah, so I think that kind of gets into my next question. I'm wondering if you can maybe just elaborate a bit on the history of African-American Islam, maybe prior to, you know, the 21st century, and what you want readers to know about that.
For me, I don't think you can tell a history of Muslims in the United States without centering the Black experience, the Black Muslim experience in this country. We have to understand, not only are Black Muslims the first Muslims to come into what would be the United States, but we also have to understand how deeply intertwined race is into the construction of religion and religious identity. So that when the early founders of the nation are thinking about who's present, who's allowed to be a citizen of this country, they're thinking of it through race, and they're trying to make a distinction with religion, but they really can't. You know, so even though Jefferson is talking about religious freedom, right, he's still enslaving people who are not Christian. And he can't conceive of a world outside of that bubble. And so to understand why he hosts the first quote-unquote iftar at the White House with his Tunisian ambassador, Mali Mali, cannot get away from the fact that Mali Mali is also whiter, phenotypically whiter. Were he darker, I'm not sure he would have had the same consideration. I'm not sure we would have had the same conversations. And I think this is all really important to consider. So I don't think we can talk about the American Muslim experience without focusing on the Black experience, not only because it frames how the country is shaped, but also because of the political activities of the longest and largest Muslim community in the United States, that is the Black Muslim community in the United States, enable so many of the civil rights that enable the practice of Islam more freely for everybody else. So I really think for me, as we go through this volume, and I think a lot of our contributors, you know, understand that you can't have these conversations about Latin Muslims in the United States absent Blackness. You can't have conversations of South Asian civil rights and political activism without considerations of Blackness. You can't talk about Arab acceptance without talking about Blackness. You can't talk about Islamophobia without talking about anti-Black racism, right? So these are all connected because that's the founding core of America. And so you need to disentangle that. You need to get to the core of that before you can start talking about Islam more broadly and freely outside of that.
This, just a little side note here. It just gets me thinking a little bit about, have you read Jamil Aydin's The Idea of the Muslim World?
Of course, yeah.
And it makes me think about the what he calls, I don't know if he coined this term, but he uses it a lot, the racialization of Muslims globally. And I mean, I'm thinking about how American Muslims fit into that sort of that process of the racialization of Muslims globally speaking. I mean, if you can't disconnect the story of enslavement and the quote unquote, you know, the founding of America from Islam, then, you know, what kind of questions does that have us consider when thinking about what we define as race and how things like discrimination play into sort of, you know, blur lines between racial identity, religious identity. Right. You know, it's discrimination is sometimes a broad stroke, you know.
I think Jamil's book is fascinating. And I know he's not focusing on the U.S. example, but obviously, as he's talking about the racialization of Muslims, and there are lots of people who've done work on this, Suad Abdul-Kabir, Edward Curtis, who I've already mentioned, Mustafa Bayoumi. But what you see is the exporting of American ideas of race and religion, how they're intertwined on a global level because of this global war on terror, but also prior to that, because of the hegemonic nature of American imperium, whether that's economically, culturally, politically, warcraft, diplomatically. All of this is through the lens of American racialization. And so, I think this is a really important connection because it does show how Muslims are treated as the other. I was a graduate student here in the early 2000s, and Harvard Divinity School refused a gift of $2.5 million for a chair in Islamic studies because it was being given by a sheikh from Abu Dhabi. From the UAE. And they said, oh, it's because he's anti-Semitic. Now, for those of you who don't know, for listeners who may not know, if you've ever been to any of the Emirates, everything is named after the ruler du jour, right? So it's the Sheikh Zayed Highway. It's the Sheikh Zayed Bridge. It's the Sheikh Zayed Public Restroom. It's the Sheikh Zayed Museum, right? It's everything is named. They're like, oh, well, this center bears his name, and therefore they had an anti-Semitic speaker, and therefore he's anti-Semitic, and also he's Arab, and he's Muslim, and therefore he's got to be anti-Semitic, and he's got to be racist, and he's got to hate America, so he can't take this money, right? So Harvard, you know, totally buys into this Islamophobic framing, rather than really trying to be intellectually honest about this. And we see this pattern repeated over and over again, where money given for Islamic studies at major universities, I'm going to continue calling out Harvard because I was a graduate student here while this was happening, where money given for Muslim studies, Islamic studies, is disappeared. It's not used for its purposes. Named chairs remain unfilled. Right? It's this idea that you can only do things that are fit within the question of American imperium. And again, I'll turn back to Edward Said in his book Covering Islam. He says, Islam is constructed in three places, devoid from any factual reality. It's constructed in academia. It's constructed in government and non-governmental spaces. And it's constructed in the media, right? And they work together He doesn't use manufactured consent, but he's building to that idea of manufacturing consent for invasion, for war, that Muslims are terrorists, that Muslims are violent, Muslims are unhuman or inhuman. And of course, this is building off his work in Orientalism, where he's talking about this in the 17th and 18th century with respect to Arabs. He's now bringing that work into the 20th century with respect to Muslims. And you can see that continuity of thought. And so when we talk about racialization, it does have this long pedigree. It's not recent. It's not modern. In fact, when we look at Harvard's Legacy of Slavery report, the fact that it doesn't talk in a meaningful way about the racialization of religion, and not just Islam, but about Judaism, Hinduism, Jainism, right, tells us that Harvard will continue to invest in the racialization of religion and not really want to move beyond that. It will not develop the expertise or listen to the expertise it has to move beyond that because it is so invested in those systems. And this is what work like, and of course it's ironic, of course Jamil came out of Harvard as well. We were students at the same time, we overlapped briefly, that the people writing most critically of this, or some of the people writing most critically of this, are actually products of the Harvard system who saw this in effect 20 years ago and are seeing it continuously play out.
Yeah. Well, to go along some of those same lines, I'd like to ask you about Islamophobia and how you, I mean, there are many, many working definitions of Islamophobia. I think there's some confusion as to, some people feel confused as to what it is. How do you define Islamophobia? And how does your definition inform our understanding of the issues faced by Muslims in American public life? And I'm thinking particularly sort of post 9/11. I mean, you mentioned that's where your journey sort of begins.
I really struggle with questions of Islamophobia. I think Islamophobia has really entered the common parlance. It's based on a report by an English nonprofit or research organization called the Runnymede Trust. It dates back to the 1980s, was when they're first using it, the mid-80s. And I think it made sense when they introduced it. And of course, what's happened is language transforms and we become more sophisticated over time. So Islamophobia, like any other phobia, implies a reactive sense of being that's not necessarily based in rationality and can't be helped. And I think that that allows people to abdicate responsibility for their bigotry and racism. Mm-hmm. I think we have to understand, and I will continue to use Islamophobia with anti-Muslim racism or anti-Muslim bias, which is the terms I've been leaning into more, but I will continue to use them interchangeably because Islamophobia has such popular cachet to it. Where I think we have to understand anti-Muslim bias is operating at three levels. One is the direct interpersonal conflict, right? I will hit you because I perceive you to be Muslim. This is the racialization question. So, for example, we know the first victim after 9/11, the first hate crime attack after 9/11 was on a Sikh man, Balbir Singh Sodhi. We've seen Hindus attack because they thought they were Muslim. We see very few black Muslims attack for being Muslim because Muslimness is tied to brownness and beardedness, right? So people like me are more likely to be perceived as Muslim, and I am Muslim, I'm not shying away from that, but are more likely to be seen as Muslim rather than a black man who is on, who wears a full regalia of a kufi and the thawb and wanting to identify very visibly as Muslim. Then you have the questions of structural violence. These are the systems put in place by formal institutions, the extra scrutiny you get at TSA or the banking regulations you have to get around, or the limits of speech that public institutions like universities or museums will put on Muslim speakers. Those are structural questions. These are rules and policies that start from racist places and attempt to be content neutral and very clearly being racist in their implementation. Then we have to understand the cultural biases. These are the television shows. This is when, if you all remember the show 24 with Jack Bauer, which premiered, which was supposed to premiere on September 11th, 2001, and was put off for obvious reasons. And the entire back third was rewritten to make the bad guys Muslim terrorists, as opposed to, I think that season was supposed to have been drug cartels is how it started.
Wow, I didn't know
And they
know
had
that.
To rewrite the entire, they rewrote the entire back third to speak into the times. And you see this in television. You see this in news reporting. NPR reporter Jermaine Williams was fired from his position. We're talking about, I would be nervous if I saw anybody get on a plane with Muslim garb. What the hell is Muslim garb, right? But this is that cultural violence that's committed. And so we have to understand, if we understand anti-Muslim bias as a form of racism, then we tie it very distinctly to anti-Black racism. And I would argue also anti-Semitism. A lot of scholars now argue that anti-Semitism is a form of racism, that it is also a racialized identity. And so we find the same tropes, right? What is the same stereotypes you find being used against Jews in the Third Reich are the same stereotypes being used against Muslims from the 1980s onwards. The big nose, the pot belly, the nouveau riche, the desire to go after the white, blonde-haired Aryan women that our country represents, meaning the United States, right? So it's using the same anti-Semitic imagery and transplanting it onto a new population. And so we have to understand all this is part of the same racist complex. So for me, Islamophobia, anti-Muslim bias, is an expression of racism that operates in three different levels, the direct, the structural, and the cultural. These are not distinct. They're all operating together. And it comes back to what I mentioned before about the idea of Islam or Muslims being authored absent any facts in academia, in government, and in media.
Thank you.
How would you say that the perception of Muslims has evolved in the American imagination?
We are recording this the day after Martin Luther King Day, and I think this is an important setting for your listeners because I'm not sure when this will actually hit the airwaves. But I've been thinking a lot about the arc of history bending towards justice, provided we work at it, which is the other part we forget. Like, it's not an organic bend. We have to put in the effort. And I want to say that for a while, I think perceptions of Muslims were getting a lot better. One thing we have to understand, coming back to this question of racialization, is that Muslims and Arabs in the American imaginary have been synonymous for centuries, right? Many of the enslaved peoples who were suing for their freedom were claiming that they were not Black African, but they were Arab African, because Arab and Muslim were synonymous. Therefore, they had a true religion, even if they were going to burn in hell for it because they weren't Christian, but also that they weren't really Black. They were just dark-skinned Arabs, right? So there's this racialized component. And this is a way of saying that I think what we saw, what we've seen in the last year and a half, 2 years, is really a fallback to the idea that Arabs and Muslims are interchangeable, Arabs and Muslims are terrorists, Arabs and Muslims are violent, they're anti-Semitic, despite all evidence to the contrary, because it is not fruitful for the war machine, it is not fruitful for American foreign policy, it is not fruitful for America's interest to really look at all of its citizens as equal. It is a fallback. And I think one of the things, what's more concerning is not just the slide back as it's happening for Muslims and Arabs in this country with the support of, again, academia and media, but really what is happening concurrently with respect to trans rights, gay rights. We will inevitably see, and we are seeing, we are seeing also attacks against Latin communities, Black communities, right? This is in part of a project of white supremacy. And one of the great tricks that white supremacy has ever played on us is that we are individuals fighting this rather than a larger collective than the white supremacists. And I think for me, when we talk about the perception of Muslims evolving, one of the things that I think opening up narratives of Muslims and focusing on Latin Muslims, focusing on Black Muslims, focusing on queer Muslims has allowed us to see potentials of solidarity that we haven't seen before. And I think for me, that is the practical implication of this change in perception, is what are the levels of solidarity that we can experience now that were not possible a decade ago?
How does national origin play into this? And let me sort of explain where I'm coming from. My own family immigrated to the United States in the late 1950s. Most of them came from Jerusalem or Amman or Beirut or Halab. And My family's Christian, Armenian, and growing up, I was always told, identify yourself as European. And so I'm curious about the connection between identity as it relates to religion and perhaps, other identities that many Muslims may have, whether that's blackness or Arabness or, identifying as also being Pakistani or what have you, right? And again, I'm thinking about sort of the structure, the structural racism that we were talking about just a minute ago, right? And do people find themselves identifying more as being Muslim and less, let's say, South Asian, for example?
That's a really broad question. Ways that I really ways that I really really like. Because I think it ties together so much of what we've talked about and opens up so many other avenues. So I think this idea of identifying as European really means Caucasian, right? Because European is a contested identity. And when you look at the United States, I mean, you can look at sociology and history books that have titles like How the Irish Became White, How the Italians Became White, How the Poles Became White, because whiteness is a social construct. And it really meant WASPs in this country, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. When you started getting people from Southern Europe, they weren't in the WASP frame. When you started getting the Irish who were Catholic, they weren't in the WASP frame. Again, this racialization of religion, like Catholicness equals not whiteness because it's not Protestant. And then, the Germans or the Italians get it worse because they're both outside the Anglo-Saxon framework and they're Catholic. So, it keeps going. So you really, for me, it's fascinating to say, identify as European, as a signifier of whiteness, when within 100 years, within the last 100 years, has been deeply contested whether European is white. And I think that's really important. Now, I think because whiteness is a construct, there are people who attempt to shoehorn their way into whiteness or this proximity to whiteness. Sharmila Sen, who used to be a faculty member here at Harvard, is now an editor at Harvard University Press, has written a memoir reflection on this sort of thing, the name of which is escaping me, but Sharmila Sen, please look her up. It's an amazing book. But this proximity to whiteness is something that is ongoing. It continues. What makes it more difficult is that when you are Indian or Pakistani or certain shades of Arab, because Arabs include multiple ethnicities and races within that, it becomes harder because of the phenotypic, the visual, physical differences are so much more. It's harder to go into. But what it does is it helps reify the idea of whiteness. And one of the things is there's this idea, I grew up with it as a kid in the 70s and 80s, this idea of the model minority. Asians are this model minority. They're good at math, they're engineers, they're science geeks. And here I am as a professor in the humanities. I'm a failed Asian. Okay. But that model minority is a term coined by the New York Times in 1971, I think, about 5 years after the Immigration and Naturalization Act. And basically the idea was, look, blacks have been in this country for 500 years and look how poor they are, and Asians have been in this country for 5 years and look at how well they're doing. So clearly it's something about black people. It's this racial laddering, right? Ignoring Jim Crow, ignoring structural racism, ignoring the fact that the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act also had what were called professional preferences, that you already had to be a professional to be able to come to this country. You had to be a doctor. You had to be a nurse. You had to be a scientist of some sort, or be studying a higher degree in those fields in order to come to this country, right? So it's sort of like, let me pick the 5 billionaires and the 5 poorest people in the world and say, see, the billionaires are such hard workers and the poor people, they deserve to be poor, and without looking at anything else, right? Let's look at the end state. And so that's how you create racial laddering. That's how you reaffirm whiteness, and how you get collaborators in white supremacy is people who think, if I follow the system, if I obey the system to the best of my ability, I will eventually be white and I will be exempt from the racial targeting that happens. And that's not actually how white supremacy works. White supremacy will always work its way down and through until it eats its own.
Thank you. So what is unique about the Latin experience with Islam?
I haven't really worked with Latin communities in the United States. I would rely on my colleagues who wrote chapters in this volume. One piece that I think, or one element that really leapt out at me, and I'm thinking here, Harold Morales has a piece in the volume where he talks about memory and the connection of memory to Andalusia. You know, 1492 and earlier, so 750 to 1492, the Iberian Peninsula is being under Arab rule, not necessarily Muslim rule. While these Arab rulers were Muslim, they obviously weren't converting the population. So, you know, yes, they were Arab and Muslim, but it wasn't a Muslim rule, it was an Arab rule. And I think it's an important distinction to make. But, you know, this idea that there is this heritage and this history, you see this with Black communities as well. Like, we came from people who were enslaved who were Muslim. This is part of our heritage. I think you see the same thing in Latin communities. This idea of playing with memory, of engaging with memory, not at an individual level, but at a cultural level. I think we often forget that memory is not just our personal experiences and what we remember, but what we remember as a society, what we remember as a culture, how that shapes our identity. Because we choose the narratives, we choose the stories, we choose the memories we have as a society in order to tell the story of who we are now, but also who we want to be. Our history is aspirational. And I think for me, Harold's essay was particularly strong in that piece. It's one of the reasons I really appreciated it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it was nice to see that topic well represented in the book.
And Ken Chitwood, of course, does a great straight history, which I think is phenomenal as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So how do you hope that this volume will be used? And what is your, very broad, what is your hope for the future of Islam in America and its study?
So for me, this book is, I've really come to appreciate edited volumes. They are a lot of work. Like, I'm not going to lie, if anybody's listening to this and thinking, oh, I should do an edited volume. Look, it's a lot of work. I thankfully, you know, knew a lot of the people in this volume before putting it together. So, you know, it was a much more collegial experience. It was a much more cooperative experience than some other volumes I've been involved with. What I want for this volume, and I think what I went into this when I tried to recruit people for this, is I want to be able to learn something as part of this experience. I want to be able to learn something from your area of expertise. And I want people to pick this up and say, I want to pass this along. And, you know, in an edited volume, you're not looking for that big arc, although we did try to have common touch points across the essays. But I think each chapter stands so well alone by itself while picking up common themes. If you read it as a book, you're going to see a scope of common questions across different communities. But if you read each chapter by itself, each one stands alone so brilliantly on its own. But edited volumes also don't often have a lot of staying power, particularly when you're dealing with contemporary issues. They have maybe a 10-year lifespan. Just because, you know, the life moves on and the way people configure themselves in society moves on. So these will move on from being cutting-edge research to being really important, I hope continue to be important historical documents, where you can trace a Sufi community in Mexico, where you can talk about representations of Muslims in the law, which is one of the chapters we have here. The idea of what a good Muslim is, Kayla Wheeler's chapter, Nimra Anansi's chapter on Muslims in the law, Irshad and Miriam's chapter on how Islamophobia shows up in education, right? Which unfortunately I think has become even more pertinent now than less pertinent, which I think is really one of the shocking things. But my hope for this is that people pick it up and they share it. This is great for classroom use, but I'm hoping people share it with other interested readers. Like, I think this would actually make really interesting historical society discussion chapters, because they are written for they're written with specialist knowledge, but for non-specialist readers. And I think that's one of the real values of this. As I said, I think this fits into an ecosystem of people who are doing really interesting work on Muslims in America, where it is not just straight histories where it's not just anthropology of one community. And that's not a critique. I think we need all of that, right? I'm a humanist. I'm a humanities scholar. We should be doing all of this. We should have the ethnomusicologist doing their specific thing. We should have the sociologist. But I think the value of this volume and some of my collaborators and colleagues in this space is that we are thinking much more multidisciplinary, so that, you know, I would love to see a volume come out on Muslims of Sydney, Australia, where you have a dozen people from a dozen different disciplines coming in and writing about the Muslims of Sydney, Australia. So you've got the historian, the sociologist, and the anthropologist. So we really are making obvious the gaps in our knowledge by doing these deep dives, because I think that's the way we end up growing the field, is by making the gaps more and more obvious, so that way people are more invested in that.
Great, thank you. To sort of wrap us up here and sort of looking forward, what's next in your research? What do you want to work on or maybe you're working on now or plan to work on soon?
So I have a few things in the fire. We'll see how they develop. I have a piece that I'm co-authoring with a former student on Muslims in horror comics. With Huma, who I co-edited this volume with that we're talking about today, we are proposing a volume on the future of Islamic studies and rethinking Islamic studies based on what we learned working on this volume. And then I co-edited another volume with two colleagues of mine, Jenna Gray Hillenbrand and Beverly McGuire, called Teaching Critical Religious Studies, which looks at how we have all this theory about why the way we teach religious studies is wrong, but we never actually bring that into our teaching. What are some classroom strategies? What's the theory that can inform our classroom strategies to do some of that work? So combining those two projects, Huma and I were like, well, what does the future of Islamic studies look like? Is if we have this approach to how Islamic studies is being taught poorly, how do we take the richness of our research to create new ways and really bring forward some cutting edge research on how do we think about Islam more broadly? So those are a couple of the projects I'm working on right now. And then with Jenna and Beverly, we might have another project coming up, continuing religious studies and its future. I'm at the point in my thinking and in my career where I'm more like, well, what happens to the next generation of scholars? And that's sort of where my head is at right now.
That's great.
Well, it's very exciting. I really enjoyed reading the volume, so thank you for talking to us and for giving us this book.
Thank you, Mariam. Thank you, Harry. Really appreciate it.
It's great having you here. Thank you, Hussein.
No. Let's keep it moving like Obama with the red lines, or Trump with the headlines and hairlines. I swear I'm a rare kind of dude, like the term for worms in Arabic. Unearth my buried heritage from cities turning derelict. All that time I had before, just wish I cherished it. All I can remember now is war. Be led to Shem, she perishes. I wish I met you in a different time. Suffice to say, I could have come up with a different rhyme. But glory days are often figments of a stricken mind, coping mechanisms for whom history hath left behind.